Good evening, and welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, June 3rd, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Our theme tonight is Don't Let the Beat Down Get You Down. The word beat down is a slang expression started in African-American communities, and it referred to the combined movement into the community of drugs, the war on drugs, a game of economic warfare, and then a media smear campaign which blamed all the goings-on on the people who lived in the community. They called it a beatdown. And it was always done in a coordinated fashion where the coordination could be denied. So it looked like the people there were drug dealers as opposed to parties outside the community were moving the drugs in along with the war on drugs. If you take that metaphor and move it to the whole, literally the whole planet, but certainly the United States at this time, what we're watching is the central banking warfare model, which has been the predominant investment and economic model for the last 500 years, is really breaking down. And as it breaks down, the people who continue to rise within any different sphere of government and corporations tend to be the people who play the harder, the dirtier, and so you have this growing corruption and really kind of a spiral down or out of control. And the reality is that the model no longer works, but we can't change it without a bit of a smash-up. The pain of not changing has to get greater than the pain of changing it, and that's a big and very deep change for something that's been in place for about 500 years. Clearly, what I call the pro-centralization team has their plan, and part of the challenge of inspiring the rest of us to come up with alternative plans has been, it was hard for many people to believe that they were really planning on doing what they're doing, because so much of what they're doing is so centralized, it's so invasive, it's so unhealthy for the majority of people and animals on the planet, that it's almost as though we needed to come out of the closet so that people can really see it. So the bad news is they're coming out of the closet, and to a certain extent things are coming to a head, and that's bad news on one hand. On the other hand, it's good news because it's part of the process we have to go through if we're going to evolve our civilization. I have a wonderful friend, Thomas Hupp, who's one of the founding members of the farm in Summertown, Tennessee, and Thomas always says, and I've had this quote up on the blog this last week, the bigger the breakdown, the bigger the breakthrough. And I think that is a wonderful way of describing our circumstance. I'm working on a new article about how institutional money managers can shift their investment practices in a way that will help create that breakthrough and protect their capital. And so it has me really excited these days about the possibilities of what can happen, what can open up as the general awareness grows. So don't let the beat down get you down. Instead, it's very appropriate. Our title for our interview tonight is the slogan from the Get Mint Trading Company, Expect Miracles. And truly, after you listen to Jim and Lynette Crosby of Crosby Mint Farms, you'll consider the how appropriate it really is to expect miracles in our lives. But first, Money and Markets and some great questions from subscribers and Ask Catherine. The Gulf oil spill, top headline in Money and Markets. The human, environmental, and economic repercussions have not yet sunk in as the last top kill solution failed. We now have groups around the world computing what could happen if this spill continued into August or even the end of the year, or two of the scenarios being considered. The nature of the response today has been mind-boggling. We're literally watching populations, state and local government, frozen in the face of a very tight, top-down, centralized, controlled effort. We literally have thousands of people in a passive state while their land and water is being destroyed. You have a $2.2 trillion GNP along the coastal lines immediately affected. It's almost as though BP lawyers are calling the shots, and it is boom times for lawyers. I posted an article about all the different lawyers and litigation expected, and, you know, unfortunately, the too much money is going to go into the wrong pockets. when that money should be being spent on cleaning up. The president of one of the most affected Louisiana parishes predicted in articles up on the blog that the spill would, quote, destroy South Louisiana. And there's no doubt about it. You're watching the real estate transactions shut down. You're watching the fishing and agricultural businesses shut down. We're waiting to see what's going to happen with hurricane season starting and what the movement of the oil and chemicals into the clouds and the rainwater and back onto the ground further inland is going to do. Because of the importance of the Gulf oil spill, both what's happened and what could happen, I'm moving back the second quarter review to the first week in July and July 1st, and Jim Norman, the author of The Oil Card, is going to return for our June 17th Solari report to discuss the Gulf oil spill. There's no one I would rather get than Jim. I'm very excited that he was willing to come back and do it. If you haven't listened to our interview of him, of his book, The Oil Card, it's very critical background for the events of what's going on with BP and the different companies involved and the full Gulf oil spill and offshore drilling. So I really recommend, if you haven't read that book and you're interested in what's really going on, the deeper geopolitics of the economy, it's a wonderful, wonderful book. It's interviewed up on the blog. Peggy Noonan last week wrote a very interesting editorial in the Wall Street Journal basically predicting that the Gulf oil spill would decimate the Obama presidency. Very interesting article. We get another article this week that will be up on the blog tomorrow morning in the top pick section. Stu Tarlow at the American Thinker saying this isn't going to hurt Obama at all. Basically, that what this will do is help the continuing to really shut down small business and to shut down the economy in America. Sounds ludicrous until you look at what's been happening with the bailouts, financial reform, the way the whole financial system has been engineered. I mean, we've literally since the beginning, well, for many years, but accelerated under this administration, literally everything possible to really it's a real beatdown on small business and small farms. Essentially, the president, as Tarlow says, works for the bondholders. And the question in this is, what do the bondholders want? I've said this before. I'll say it again. I'm terrified that the Gulf oil spill will be used to push for a new round of cap-and-trade legislation. The president's been intimating as much. The cap-and-trade that would come out of that is a global taxation system, which represents not only a completely centralized control system, but one that doesn't require legislation to implement taxation. All you need is academics, well-paid and controlled by bankers, to opine as to how much this is worth or how much that is worth. I mean, and we could literally see a global taxation system where you have to pay for the right to breathe. So it's a very dangerous precedent to get going. And I would say that such a system is going to be more dangerous to life on this planet than the spill itself. A few comments about the events in the Middle East, which is clearly one of the hot spots. It's extremely difficult to explain Israel's recent behavior, the attack on the flotilla. I'm sure there's a logical explanation, but no one outside some of the intelligence agencies appear to have it. The fact of the matter is the Israeli government continues to have to be led by a very insecure, volatile leadership that has a very powerful stockpile of nuclear weapons. That's not a good combination. There's an interesting story in the Guardian earlier this week about how the Afghans all assume that the U.S. is funding the Taliban so that we have an excuse to stay. The fact that they believe this is not surprising at all. Lots of people believe it, and the evidence is pretty good, particularly because we're controlling that aspect of the opium trade, and it fits in with the global narcotics trafficking that we and our allies have controlled for quite some time. The fact that the Guardian is writing about it so openly I find to be very interesting. That story is up on the blog if you want to check it out. As far as I'm concerned, the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq is intended to be permanent. They will become outposts of the empire. Again, that reflects the importance of the Eurasian continent both to the management of Russia and China, but really an exploding area of economic activity. So if the financial institutions want to maintain their lead, they've got to capture a big part of that market share. And where they go, the military goes first. The challenge of making that a permanent occupation is underscored by the dreadfulness of the latest foundation, the latest conference coming out of the Kauffman Foundation. And I posted this up on the blog last week. It's called The Summit on Entrepreneurship and Expeditionary Economics. And let me explain what expeditionary economics is. I'm going to read to you. The Summit on Entrepreneurship and Expeditionary Economics will engage leading scholars, thinkers, and practitioners of economics, counterinsurgency, and stability operations to present and discuss their thoughts on how to achieve sustainable economic development in post-conflict, post-catastrophic areas. This is my comment. This is all part of the shock doctrine, economics and disaster economics. The Kauffman Foundation and the Command and General Staff College Foundation, that's the U.S. military, view expeditionary economics, which are now, they have an acronym EE, as a framework for thinking about how to stimulate economic growth in post-combat zones where the American military is about to perform, is performing as concluded a mission. The premise of EE is the long-term success of armed engagements will depend on the performance of the economy once combat subsides and the process of rebuilding begins, and further that building capacity to establish entrepreneurial capitalism and economic growth is the best way to achieve our post-conflict, post-catastrophe goals. Okay, now, if you look at Merrill Kauffman was a remarkable entrepreneur who late in his life took an extraordinary amount of money, created the Kauffman Foundation with a goal of helping encourage the teaching and education of entrepreneurship. I believe if Merrill Kauffman could see this conference, he'd turn over in his grave. In fact, 50% of the money was supposed to go to kids and young people to help them learn to grow up to be entrepreneurs. Believe it or not, the conference is being organized by the head of research, Bob Lytan. It's one of the most talented people I ever worked with in the Clinton administration. Extraordinary guy. The fact that Bob's talent is being used in this manner is really a comment on the growing need for a breakthrough. But basically, what is this? It's a real desire to create an entire academic body of knowledge about how we can conquer a place and then get everybody working as quickly as possible for us so that the cost of conquering it gets much more attractive. It underscores the state of where we are. New employment numbers, which are hogwash. For the real numbers, you need to look at things that express real cash flows. Article at the top of the blog this week, food stamps are now 40.2 million. They've been rising steadily for about 16 months. The White House budget predicts next year there will be 43.3 million people on food stamps. That's another 3 million people going on food stamps. Another story that's a great comment on the real economy, AEP, which is American Electric Power, one of the nation's biggest power generators, announced yesterday morning that 10 of its smaller generating units will remain offline for much of the year because of lower demand for electricity. So whether it's food stamps or what's happening with electricity demand, what we're seeing is the sort of the outside part of the economy continues to shrink. Now, what's happening with the dollar as that happens? The dollar's the king of the road, some say, and crash and burn, some others say. A client sent me an amazing list early this week of 20-plus commentators explaining why the U.S. was going to implode and crash and the dollar fall this year. That includes Cliff High's new report from Half Past Human, A New Shape of Things to Come publication, which is quite dire. The same day I was reading all of this, I read Kiplinger's latest newsletter predicting that the dollar would stay the preferred safe haven for the year. And sure enough, that's what we continue to see with money leaving the euro, nervousness all around the globe for a variety of reasons. And so the dollar is flying despite the fundamentals. There's a great quote I put up today from Bradley Alford at Alpha Capital Management from an article on hedge funds. Quote, the only things that really worked last month were gold, treasuries, and cash. Now, what is Kiplinger saying versus the rest? He's saying, essentially, that the scenario he's predicting is what I call the slow burn, and he's predicting it to hold throughout the year. I've given the slow burn this year a 70% chance of being the likely scenario. If the meltdown scenario comes true, and I don't think it will, but it could, I give that a 30% chance. If the meltdown scenario happens, it's critical to important that it probably won't be the system that meltdown. It will simply be most people. We have to remember that everything that's happening in terms of unemployment and the drop in income of most middle-class people, both here and in Europe, was planned since the early 90s. It was understood that this would happen. I keep mentioning the Sir James Goldsmith video up on the blog, but it's such a great story or interview to explain that this was all really known back in the early 90s. And I was in the middle of the policy conversations at that time in Washington, and I can assure you that it was. So it was planned that the majority of Americans would reduce their lifestyle to a much more modest lifestyle. So what's happening in one sense is not really a meltdown. It's really a reengineering organized in a way that will, the meltdown of the outsiders will serve to increase the sustainability of the insider-run system itself. This is one of the reasons I really wanted you to hear the special report we did with Cliff Cornicum last night. And, of course, the one we did last month with him. But one of the things we really talked about is the possibility of invisible weaponry systems and the impact that they can have on the economics of the situation. I always laugh about a comment I made. I'm on a listserv with a group of you know, sort of luminaries of the financial blogosphere, and they were talking about how the dollar was going to crash, and I got on and I said, has everybody here seen the documentary Phoenix Lights, which is a documentary we've had on the Solari Report? I really encourage you to watch it. It's about a UFO that floated down the side of Arizona in the late, I think it was 1996 or 97. And so they all said, yeah, we've seen the documentary Phoenix Lights. And I said, well, I think the dollar's going to do whatever the guy who owns that spaceship says it's going to do. And it's sort of my comment of reminding everyone that we're dealing with an economy right now that's driven by force and very powerful invisible force that we don't all necessarily understand, as opposed to fundamental economics. That takes us to, if we're going to talk about how the dollar is going to do state and local government, we have now accumulated about $130 billion of deficits that have to be closed, most of it with budgets in the next 30 to 40 days. Most state and local governments most state governments end their budget year in June 30. So we are seeing more headlines of state and local governments considering bankruptcy. Part of the problem is the unfunded liabilities of state and local pension funds made much worse by the drop in the stock market, and if the stock market continues to fall, that could get even worse. This means trouble ahead. We'll start to see and hear about it in the fall. And next year, most of the bonds in the municipal $2.8 trillion municipal note and bond market have reserve funds of a variety, so it should really start to hit next year and the year after. But you want to be extremely careful about the quality of any municipal bonds, bond funds, and money markets you hold at this point, because we're going to see a gapping between the high quality and the low quality in the market. We're also continuing to see, as I keep reminding, divide and conquer efforts to turn the population against government workers and unions, and also politics of immigration and race. Just don't fall for any of it. Just leave those conversations. Pray for everybody, but don't fall for the divide and conquer. Concerns about the stock market grow. Expect global stock markets to continue to weaken. Much of the concerns relate to the debt, but that's not entirely it's not entirely a debt problem. There's a real breakdown in trust. No one can price assets if they don't have good quality information that they can depend on, whether from the rating agencies or the issuers or from the government regulators who are supposed to collect disclosure. That means they can't price assets. They can't price risk. Parties continue not to be counted on to keep contracts. The dirty tricks continue to grow. What that means is it's a little bit like the days of old in China, or other countries where warlords take over and the fundamental conditions of lawful commerce disappear. So that means equity is going to continue to shrink for some period of time as we work through the breakdown to, you know, before the breakthrough. And again, it's not just because we're managing a debt overhang, but because faith in the financial and legal systems is falling. Our hero this week, you have to watch this, it's fabulous, is a guy named John Christensen, who's the founder of Iceland's new, it's called Best Party. It consists, the initial group consists primarily of artists and musicians who just engineered a sweep in the latest municipal elections. Among other things, they promised a new polar bear for the zoo. It's fabulous. Their campaign song is up on the blog. It's written to the tune of Tina Turner's You're Simply the Best. It will give you just a great chuckle. What they did was, among other things, they captured the hunger for excellence and imagination in the body politic, not just in Iceland, but throughout the planet. The New World Order just sends a feeling and a message of mediocrity. And, you know, this is a group of people getting together and saying, no, we want to be excellent. It's really fantastic. Anyway, it's up on the blog, The Best Party from Iceland. Okay, so ask Catherine some great questions. Let me go through them quickly. A couple on the chemtrail issues. A greater object of beauty. I'm having trouble ingesting the idea of being poisoned on a planetary level. Any comedians you can recommend to help boost the mind and body connection with a few hee-hee-ha-has? The answer is I don't know of a comedian who's addressed chemtrails, but we really need one. That's such a great idea. So that's an opportunity. But if anybody sees one, send them my way at communicate@solari.com. Lex Luthor, ruler of Australia. If the chemtrail planes operate at a level visible to pedestrians and they're spraying globally, doesn't that mean that no country on this planet has basic control of its low-level airspace? The answer is yes. Or I would say this, say it a different way. All the governments have integrated the implementation of this into their policies. Now, that may not be a public policy, but this spraying is done with the concurrence and help of all the local governments, which gets back, if I'm right, to the power of the invisible weaponry, whether financial or military, that's behind this. How can the U.S. sell arms to anyone if no one has the power to shoot down a plane which is hostile? Again, I don't think the planes are hostile. And if you look at the arms sales that the U.S. makes, they're not, you know, one, the countries don't always necessarily need the arms. They need to impress the United States. And also the arms relate to the, you know, sort of the local regional politics and the balance of power regionally. There's a wonderful, we covered the movie The International in an earlier Solari report, but if you haven't watched the movie The International, to see sort of how the arms fit into the whole sort of economic warfare game, it's really worth it. Another question on the Gulf. Does credibility appear from this perspective on the Gulf oil leak? And then points to Henry Mackow's article suggesting the Gulf oil spill came not from an accident but from sabotage. I think that that's a reasonable possibility. I'd give it about 40 or 50%. I think we don't know. But it's far from implausible that the Gulf oil leak was the result of an act of war as opposed to simply an accident. Another question, doesn't this situation look like a black swan? It took a major turn for the worse on Sunday, several explosions. It's flowing at a tremendous rate, and BP is probably not going to be able to plug the flow. the impact could be a black swan kind of impact, for sure. So, and again, we really don't know how bad it could be, but the imagination can take you to some pretty bad scenarios. Banking in North Dakota. Alex Jones discussed North Dakota's federally segregated banking system that arose years ago through a populist farmer movement. Is it possible for a Chicago resident to bank in North Dakota? And if so, would you recommend it over supporting relying upon a regional bank? It's true the North Dakota banking system is more separate. They have their own state bank. It is stronger. The economy in North Dakota relative to other states is very strong. The idea of banking in a North Dakota bank, if it's a very well managed one, a good one, is not such a crazy idea at all. Again, I would only bank at a bank where I had a relationship. So to do this, you're going to have to get in a car and go meet some bankers and pick one you feel comfortable with. I live in Tennessee, and I bank at a bank over almost 1,000 miles away in Pennsylvania, which is a very strong and extraordinary community bank. So, now you can bank at long distance. I do it, but it has its pros and cons. But it's not such a crazy idea. We have some great questions on what to do, how an expat should buy gold, whether there or take delivery in the United States, and we'll address those questions in next week's Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. So that's it for Ask Catherine, and now we turn to, and this is really my pleasure, to introduce you to Jim and Lynette Crosby, brother and sister. They own and operate Crosby Mint Farm, and you can tell from our blog post, I met them virtually in 2008 when I heard about their situation and encouraged people to support them. And at the time, I put in a big order of a Love Mint, and I put in a big order of for spearmint and peppermint oil. It came. It was so fabulous. I gave it to everybody for Christmas and immediately had to put in another order. And if you look at the blog post, it continued with me learning more and more about Crosby Mint Farm and their predicament in fighting foreclosure at the farm. And then finally in February, just an incredible compliment to two people who never gave up, no matter how dire the situation was. Caroline Casey always says that our situation is far too dire for the luxury of realism. And the motto on the Get Mint Trading Company, which is their online store where they sell their mint and other wonderful products, is expect miracles. And sure enough, they got one. So it's my pleasure to introduce to you Jim and Lynette Crosby, coming to you from Crosby Mint Farm. Are you there? Are you with us?
I'm here.
Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Catherine. Hi, everyone.
Hi. Well, let's begin. If you could give us a history of the farm and sort of your area, that would be wonderful.
Jim, would you like to take that?
Oh, sure. The farm was actually established in 1912 by my great-grandfather, J.E. Crosby. And he had a successful dairy operation and delivery of milk in Dayton, Ohio. And he had lost his farm due to a really bad flood and had moved up here. And
tell us where you are.
We are located right, if you look at your hand and point right to the center, we're located in the center of the state of Michigan, St. John's.
Okay.
And at that time, in the early teens, there was over 60 mint distilleries. We used to produce a third of the world's oil. And, it was very successful until the market started changing. And now corporate farms have pretty much taken over, and there's a small handful of us small producers left actually within the country. That would be probably maybe 15 or 20 of us left.
And there are four in the St. John's area, or there were last year?
Yes, there's four that I know of. One that I thought was still in production, and they had went to dairy and got out of the mint. And but right now, I believe there are four. There could be three of us, but we are one of those four.
And you're the oldest, or one of the oldest operating left.
Yes, we're actually the oldest growing and producing mint farm, meaning that. Even though that we have an online store, we still continue to produce and sell what we produce and to continue the harvest. Our own distilling, been known as or called as the artesian distiller, because a lot of the technology that we're using is actually, from the 40s and the 50s. And so a lot of what we do or I do on the distilling part of it is all hands-on. It's just, something I've learned being around the distillery my whole life and learning from my father, because my father was actually the distiller, and then we had an uncle that was the field production and would bring mint into the distillery. So I really learned from my father, feeding it at a very young age with wood until we switched over to fossil fuel. And but that's, I mean, the technology is very, we're very behind.
Now you're, well, you know, I have a, here in Hickory Valley, we call it so far behind, we're ahead. So you may not be behind, you may be ahead. So tell us, when does the harvest come in? The mint harvest starts now?
Well, actually, it's towards the end of July for here. It's end of July to the first 2 weeks in August. It depends on, you know, those days, Catherine, when it is humid and you just stand there and you sweat.
Uh-huh.
And that is when that is when harvest is. And that's when the mint runs, or the oil is being actually pulled from the plant material, and it runs for some reason. It just runs. It's just
right.
A beautiful thing to see when it comes. And harvest will generally last maybe 2 weeks. Spearmint comes in first. We produce two things: peppermint and spearmint. And then peppermint will blossom or mature later. And generally, we've harvested as late as early September, but we try to wrap everything up within an amount of time. But it just depends on what the plant tells us, because when we harvest, we use a blossom that is produced by the plant, and that's a maturity indicator. And when that mint plant has the blossom at the top, that allows me or tells me that the oil that is stored in the glands of the leaves, it's the most optimum. And if we don't take it within a timely fashion, the mint actually starts to recede back. And so then all your efforts for that year, all your field work, everything that you've done to try to keep the crop, it all comes down to the 2 weeks. Because my father always said, you may have good-looking mint, but it doesn't count until you get into the barrel.
Right.
And he was so.
So, and when do you distill?
Well, that's part of the harvest. It's harvested a lot like hay or alfalfa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we let it cure. We cut it into rows, and then we have a machine called a chopper, and that'll pick the mint up and cut it into very small, fine pieces and blow it back into a wagon, but it's similar to a huge pressure cooker. And we'll bring it into the distillery and hook a steam line up to it, and we'll pump steam through it, and we give it so many turns, and after about 20 minutes, when that steam comes all the way through the load, it'll start building up pressure. And the best way I can explain is that the oil is pulled from the plant material and attaches itself to the steam, and then it goes through a cold water condenser and then to a separator can. And in that separator can, obviously, oil separates from water, and the pure extract will rest right on top with the water being on the bottom. And then all we do after about an hour and 10 minutes, or when it stops running, it's kind of a, just a reed thing, we'll raise the water level and skim the pure essential oil right off the top.
So you have to tell me, why is your, because I've used a lot of natural oils in my life, why is your oil so special? It's so pure. It's so clear. It's so lifting. You know, if I'm tired, I have a headache, or I have a cold, or what, it's just like, woo! You know, if I fall into a lower mind, your oil will take me right. I have it in diffusers all over the house. So you have to tell us, why is it so fabulous?
Well, one of the key factors is the some of the rootstock that we have is actually, 70 years old.
Uh-huh.
And, it's a sterile plant, and it keeps producing every year. And the second is that our production, or all of our mint ground, is actually carved out by a glacier, and it's organic muck material. It's not black dirt, but it's actually organic muck material. And traditionally, when mint was produced for holistic and for flavoring, and that was where the mint came from. And now a lot of the mint is grown in areas that should not be growing mint. A lot of it's genetically altered, hybrid, GMO mint. That's just geared to overproduce. So that's where your benchmark is that, you get something that says, one, do not ingest, two, use the oil as a dilutant or a carrier oil.
Right.
Normally with our oil, it's always been used that, if you have to dilute it, you can with a neutral oil like an olive oil, but most of our customers can use the oil straight, and it doesn't hurt, doesn't burn. The menthol
right.
contents, right? It's all natural. There's
right.
no tampering with it. One point of origin.
Okay, so tell us what happened. How did this foreclosure, your squabble with your bank and the foreclosure saga begin?
Lynette, would you like to
Yeah, I'd love to. Well, in 2004, we took out an operating loan and remortgaged when our father was still alive. And we get behind in the payment. Our father died in 2005. We created a new business model, an executive summary, to expand operations that we thought would bring and get us through that hump. What happened was we ended up having four separate loans, and we defaulted on one payment, one loan. And so they gave us an extension. I think it was 60 days extension. And we went in there before those 60 days were up, and we asked to restructure. And we were sent paperwork that we had the right to, you know, request a restructure. And we went in there, and they said, sorry, but that's just, you know, it's customary to send the paperwork, but don't bother. So we didn't. So what happened is they were able to call all four notes at the same time. That was, you know, in the paperwork that because they defaulted on one loan. What happened was a series of it would have been 3 years, April 27th, that we started what they called negotiations or meetings with the bank. One particular loan officer, the risk manager, and an outside attorney. That we dealt with, the same two men who had been working together for 20-some years as a team. And it just was like a breakdown process for us. It's like almost, you know, being interrogated. And once a month we go in there and we, you know, give them an update, and they really encourage us to liquidate. Well, we did liquidate most of our equipment, a lot of oil, and continue to pressure us. And, you know, just the whole process of finally setting us into foreclosure. Well, actually, I have to back up a little bit. We jimmed a bankruptcy to hold off any foreclosure process or having them be able to come in and get the equipment. So that kind of slowed. They were not happy with that decision on our part, but it did slow down the process a bit. So that, you know, just it was a progressive, you know, march towards eviction. And they foreclosed on us. When we have a, you know, annual Mint Festival in our city, it brings in probably 60,000 people. We're called Mint Cities USA, and the bank, you know, very boldly, you know, posted our foreclosure notices right at the timing when we'd have tours on our farm. So everything was always happened yearly around the Mint Festival. Well, what happened was in 08, I'm trying to think now, they posted the sheriff sale. So we had that right at the Mint Festival. And then they gave us a year redemption period to attempt to raise that money. And we did not. Then they foreclosed. Then we had the eviction on August 28th.
When you say you didn't pay it, it was they had accelerated all the loans. So it was an extraordinary amount of money.
Now, and I should back up to say that, you know, they did receive $115,000 in equipment and oil sales, and they also received another $345,000 cash from a partner that we had been in business with. So they received all this money. And on top of that, and I can feel my body just get a little bit anxiety-ridden, was that, you know, at this time, the attorney's fees are just rising. I mean, they're tacking those onto our operating loan at default rates and
right.
not giving us an invoice of any type of any kind of, you know, monthly hours or minutes this attorney was, you know, they were charging us. They were just doing things that were very bold and obviously they were used to doing. So, and there's so much in between that, you know, we could go on, and I know we don't have enough time, but that's really what happened. And then the farm went to auction.
Mm-hmm.
This past December 10th of 2009, and that's what happened. Now we.
What's interesting is this happened. Let's step back. You had put up an online store, and as more and more people were communicating, you know, help Crosby Mint Farm. There was a real campaign that kind of took off.
Yes.
And your your store started to produce extraordinary amounts of cash flow.
It did, and yes. it was in the fall, and we one email out. I remember it was only to maybe 500 people, and it may sound like a lot, but we went through phone books and magazines and people that we thought may use oil, and just sent this one really minimal email out and put a date on it. And within 2 weeks, nothing happened. That was the first week, the second week, and the third week, and all of a sudden, orders started flowing in around the country and even around the world.
Well, I remember I got permission from the guys at Coast to Coast to talk about the farm and to get everybody to go read the blog post about it and to go to the store, and I think lots of people were doing that.
Yes,
so
it
caught on.
It caught on, and I remember my birthday, December 5th of 2008. I got up in the morning, and I went to the website and looked at the orders, and there were all these orders in our shopping cart, and I said, well, you know what? Something must have happened last night. Somebody out there spoke about us, and you know what, Catherine? It was you. You
were really?
You were on Coast to Coast Radio.
Uh-huh.
And because people had commented, I was curious, like, why are we getting, why now? There's just this spurt of orders, and it was you, so thank you. And I remember that was my birthday present.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, but one of the things I remember is you were producing cash flows that were far more than you needed to service the outstanding loans, even to rapidly amortize it.
Yeah.
So it made no economic sense for the bank to shut you down. But you were in one of those situations, which we've seen many times, where banks can get more helping a company which is sustainable fail than helping them succeed.
Mm-hmm.
You really have this win-lose relationship, and one of the reasons was part of your mortgage or part of the loans were government guaranteed. So the bank really didn't care; they just get the government guarantee.
Well, correct. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I also wanted to mention, Catherine. Not only was it government guaranteed, but also too. That this is from looking back at everything and the research I've done. I also believe that our mortgage was also sold on the Farmer May and the Farmer Mac model of that we had discussed probably a long time ago. And I found data showing that the agricultural land or property is sold to those markets, but what are the gold nugget or the heavy seller is when they're FSA, or excuse me, loan guaranteed behind that.
Well, it's very interesting. When I worked at the FHA, what I found was that government guarantees, mortgage guarantees, and subsidies, related business subsidies, were really used to get the banks to engineer what were uneconomic goals in a community, but were policy goals. So you would see government mortgage used to really do things that were very harmful to small business and communities, and again and again and again. And it's one of the reasons I stay as far away as I can from government programs and government subsidies, because they may look like they save you money, but they lock you into these multiple agendas that literally turn you and the bank into win-lose relationships. Now, mention, if you will, the dirty tricks, because you ran into some very significant computer hacking of the online store as it started to do really well. And that's part of some of the mystery of what really happened.
Yeah. Well, do you want me to take that, or you want to take that?
I can start it, and then
sure.
Like you said before, Catherine, our online sales, on a daily basis, just started increasing, we couldn't believe it. And one day, I remember it was October 28th, and all of a sudden, our website went down. And actually, our webmaster in Wisconsin called. He said, "Who does not like you? Who wants to shut you down?" But we're stunned, because here we are. We can see hope and and just the kindness of others coming through. And all of a sudden, it's just like we take
the thing. It was amazing. You were cash flowing fast enough to really pay off all your debt.
Yes, we were. We were, and it immediately cut us off. And not only that, you know, we had thousands of orders that had come in, and we couldn't get to those. How do we fulfill those orders that already had sent them in? So, I mean, it was just a great, you know, have stacks of reams of paper and orders to fulfill, and then we can't get to the data to send those out. So that was a dilemma. And then how do we get back up again, and how do we tell people? I mean, people were calling our 800 number, and at the time it was directed to my cell phone. I could not keep my mailbox clear because every time I deleted something, we had volunteers coming to the farm, and they were just taking, you know, we're trying to take the messages as fast as we could and return those phone calls and people, you know, wanting to help. And it was so our webmaster said, hey, you know, I'm going to check into this, and he did, and he collected the data and did the research, and we hired a forensic specialist to confirm his findings. And Jim, if you'd like to pick up from there, that'd be great.
Yeah, so what it showed was that it went back to a state technology facility, and that they were hitting our pay port. And what was happening, it was like somebody on the other end was hitting the submit button. And now a normal denial service attack hits every page on the website. And what was said to me was that the only time that they see this type of attack is corporate espionage, when another corporation wants to shut down or stop something from another corporation, not to save a farm for $5. And that was, you know, buy a dram for $5, save a farm. And so what they were doing is hitting the submit button so nobody could order. No orders could come in. It slowed people from watching the pages. And I ended up kind of not going the right route, and I ended up, you know, filing a complaint with the state police. They were going to follow up, lock down the building. Later on, there was no complaint number. They never entered the state facility. Nothing was ever, everything that was told that an investigation was being done, it never happened. But yet, we were hit 3,900 times in an 8-hour period on that one pay port, and it literally, I mean, lost. I mean, we were doing $15,000 a day in sales. I mean, we could have really easily, with the help of these folks coming out all over the country, could have, you know, we could have paid this off. And mysteriously, you know, it happened.
Now, this started right after, was it the bank? You told the bank that you could, you would be able to pay off the loan just from your sales.
Well, it was actually, we had several conversations. We went to our state capitol and talked to every senator, everybody that you could think of, even the governor. We either would not get acknowledged and or we'll try to do something, we'll work on it. Since our loan was a federal guaranteed loan, since the bank was a federally chartered bank and not a private bank, so it had to be somebody in a federal position. And that was one of the persons that we are talking to the aide, and I will be accountable for this, as I explained. You know, we're doing this amount of money. Yes, we still need help, and please give us the time. And keep in mind, that was during the campaign time. And, you know, their office was silent all the way through this. And that was on the 27th, and then at 8:30 on the 28th. And then what was real key was that the person that was the administrator for this IP address, the state police did say that they talked to him. He said that he admitted that he was on our site, but he was there to buy product. And so that's really the only tie that I can get. And I believe that, you know, somebody from the federal government end of it had made a call and had lunch and said, listen, you know, crash this site. You know, they thought we had a $1.98 website. You know, if we had that technology, we would have never known or found out or traced it back. But the technology that we were using was actually personally put together by this webmaster, and he's won several awards in Forbes magazine for it. And so what's nice about it is he gave us this technology, and he took it personal because somebody was trying to attack us.
So really, I mean, what you saw again and again was a lending party and a farm, and the lending party wanted the business to fail when it didn't need to.
Absolutely.
So the thing that was incredible is the support that emerged was greater than all the opposition. So tell us about where your support came from and sort of how it gathered and came together.
Well, it came from...
Go ahead.
Actually, across the country. I mean, I believe we... I mean, our community rallied for us, but I'll tell you what, it was really more outside our community that really rallied for us. And we had a core group of community helpers with the farm who believed in us and, you know, felt a part of it. And they felt they took it personal that we would be attacked as well. I really built that, and then it was just the kindness of others that, you know, prayer. And there weren't any politicians that helped. No one really came forward. When we tried that, like Jim said, we went to the Capitol and spoke to several senators, and they told us not to get involved with certain people. It was a heightened time, too, because it was the presidential election in November was coming up. And so I really believe that the politicians were involved with the bank, and there's a whole secrecy thing going there. I don't know why, but we had a lot of supporters, like your listeners, other listeners around the country. It was incredible, the outreach. When you think that people don't pay attention or care, it's like I've learned such a lesson through this that it's really about community.
Well, my impression is that thousands and thousands of people were either buying or praying or, you know, taking some kind of action or passing your emails on or signing up with you on Facebook. I mean, it was a lot of people.
Yeah. You know, the social media was really instrumental in getting, you know, word out. And just email in general and, you know, like yourself and bloggers were contacting us.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's how Jim found you initially. Was when I read that.
Yeah, I think I posted something on the blog and Jim saw it, and I got an email from him.
So, I mean, the bloggers, and we've made friends with people, and you know, and at the same time, we're trying to get this forward and do everything we can, and we have all this information coming in at us, and not all the information was valid. I mean, there were people wanting to take advantage of our situation, so there were people that were, we can get you, you know. We can do a search of the loan and make sure that it's legal and, you know, all it's going to cost you is $5,000 and this is going to help you. I mean, there was that sort of thing. So we had to weed through what is really valid, what is really resonates that's going to help us. And that took time. So I'll tell you what.
You guys must have been working 100-hour weeks.
Well, it was a three-year process and, it's incredible, but to be standing here, I'm in the farmhouse, Jim's out in the barn, I can see him on the phone. It's an incredible feeling to stand here and talk to you and to look over the farm. It's like, we never thought this would happen. I guess we did, you know, that expected.
Well, you lived through the auction, you lost it. It was foreclosed, it was auctioned. You lived through all of that, but now you've got it back.
Yeah.
Now tell us about you. You know, one of the things I talk a lot about, both on the blog and in the Solari Report, is the importance of finding ways of circulating private equity, you know, within communities and between communities without going through Wall Street. And your happy ending happened because you had a private investor.
Yes.
And it's, you know, that kind of private investment is what we need to free us of dependency on the banking system and these kinds of dirty tricks. And, you know, so...
Well, there's one thing that he's always said, this person, was that he invests in the people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he did. He invested in us because he saw the efforts, he saw the possibilities, he saw our intent. And intent, you know, there's a lot of businesses and there's a lot of great ideas. But if you look at the people and you look at the intent, and what I've always said is that look at people behind the business, and that is who you're dealing with. You know what you have, because we do everything here as a long-term relationship. We've held ourselves accountable for everything. And So you just, you know, you take that and you look at the people and what they're trying to do and the intent and where, because there's nothing, Captain, there's nothing wrong with making money when you give quality and you give benefit and the natural law of exchange, as I call it, you know, because we're offering something that improves quality of life, and that's what everything is. Everybody here that works here believes in that same philosophy, is that we're helping people through what we do and love. You know, you find businesses that do that, the growing food, the small producers, the small,
right.
Ag producers, I mean, food, I mean, we need food. We need nutrition.
We need food, and we need high-quality food. So I'm really hoping, you know, what I keep hoping is to inspire the people who have the resources within the Solari Network to really think about where are the opportunities to invest, to make strategic investments in farmers and farmland that will help secure the kind of food that we need, you know, including the investors. Because I think the day is coming when it's going to be very hard to just walk into any store and buy it. So, you know, you really, I think just from my standpoint, because I've watched you for almost 2 years, when did it, I guess November, so a year and a half, what you would see is great product, great people. They never give up. They're always adding, you know, adding value to their customers, and they just keep adding value no matter what they get hit with. They keep adding value. And, you know, and the product was so great, the people were so great, and your performance was so faithful that I think it just kind of shifted everything. And I hope your investor does really well. And so why don't you tell us, just before we close, what did you learn from your experience that you think, you know, because you experienced your own little beat down, but everybody in America and in Europe and a lot of the places listening tonight are dealing with their own kind of beat down. So it may not be preserving the family farm. It may be something else. But what can you tell us about what led to your success in the face of some pretty extraordinary things that could help us all learn to do a better job of dealing with the ones that we're all managing?
Well, Lynette, you want me to take that? Or?
Well, then we can both take it. I think that we both come from different places that, you know, we all had a personal experience. For me, you mentioned the quote that the biggest breakdowns are the biggest breakthroughs. And I think that, you know, I just stayed grateful for what we had, grateful for the people who supported us. With that thread, that common thread that kept pulling us through, it was about people. And the biggest breakthrough personally was learning that when you step into community is where things happen. And when you're by yourself, you're by yourself, you know, it's dark. And for me, my biggest breakthrough was just learning that to step into it and accept help and accept the graces of others. And this has been my, by large, I mean, I have never experienced anything so deeply, profoundly grieving. I grieved terribly, as I'm sure Jim did, and to experience, and the opposite of that, to have extreme gratitude. So I'm actually feel very blessed to have gone through it. I'm extremely grateful for the outcome, but I would have been grateful. I was grateful for the outcome all the way through. So maybe for me, it was just being grateful and having people in my life and, you know, being blessed.
You certainly have a very broad-based group of customers now.
We do. We really do.
All walks of life.
They're awesome. They're amazing. And they promote our product for us, as you do when you speak of it, you know.
Uh-huh.
At the market every day, we have people come up and say, oh, you know, I have a migraine, I have a sinus, what can I do? And they start telling us their stories and how they use it. And it's really wonderful. So that was mine.
Jim, what would you say?
It was a lot of gratitude. And I had to learn to be kind to myself and surround myself around people that cared and accept that caringness when I wanted to have my own pity party or just be by myself. But I call it evacuated from the farm because we only had 3.5 days to pack everything up and still complete a harvest. What I learned was that I will not quit. If they can take this farm, they can try to do whatever they want, but I believe in so much in what producers can do and what the oil can do to help people. And it's about relationships. That's what got me through, was about helping other people.
Well, you can feel it when you put the oil on your neck. You know, it comes through. So it works. So tell us how we can connect. Just give us 30 seconds on how we can find you on the web.
Okay. Go ahead, Jim.
Can
I just say one thing first? Is that anybody going through this situation, to stay in the media. They can get themselves out in the media in any way they can. That's key, too. And TV,
oh, yeah.
Paper, yeah.
Don't roll. Don't lie down.
Do YouTube, and it's cheap. You know, you just put it out there. Post.
Yeah, you guys did great videos. You have a couple of great videos up. We put one up on the blog post. And I think those videos did a great job of telling the history and the product and the story. You know, that was an important component.
Well, people can, if they want to reach out or check us out, is getmint.com, GetMint.com, getmint.com. And then they can also reach out to peppermintgym.com as well. But everything goes to the same place, and we're working to move forward, and it's on. And when this is, we get our teeth back, we're committed to help others and support those that are going through rough times as well.
And when they come to your area, they can find you at a farmer's market? Where do they find you locally?
The Lansing City Market, which is at our capital of Michigan, but the Lansing City Market, we're there. And we're going to be hopefully growing and getting more distributors out there for our products. And so hopefully, one day soon that you'll...
Oh, fabulous. Can we be an affiliate?
Sure.
Okay. Well, Lynette, Jim, thank you so much. And
thank you.
Just grow and prosper. We need you strong and thriving. And you've been an inspiration to me and to everybody on the Soleri team and the Soleri Network. And I just want to thank you for that. And thank you for the fabulous mint oil, which makes my life better and makes my family's life better, because they all get it every year for Christmas.
There's a lot of love in those bottles.
There sure is. Okay.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you, Lynette.
Thank you.
Coming up June 10th, the Precious Metals Market Report. There's so much going on in the markets. We have lots to talk about. June 17th, Jim Norman on the Gulf oil spill. July 1st, the second quarter wrap-up. And until then, you're in our prayers. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.